decades, calling for urgent steps to protect journalists worldwide. According to Palestinian officials, over 180 journalists have been killed in Israel's aggression against Gaza since October last year. Dozens of journalists have also been killed in Lebanon. Meanwhile, today marks the anniversary of the Balfour Declaration as well, which led to the creation of Israel by the West by uprooting Palestinians from their ancestral lands. On this day, in 1917, then British Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour issued an infamous statement to pledge the settlement of European Jews on Palestinian territories. Palestinian author and commentator Mazen Qumsia says the Israeli regime is killing journalists in Gaza as part of an extermination campaign aimed at silencing voices that are critical to any civil society.
It engages in killing journalists, hospital doctors, civil defense officials, university. I'm at Bethlehem University, and I know what's happening with the universities in Gaza. We wrote an article about the research article about the destruction of the universities in Gaza, the colleges, the killing of professors and workers and students at the universities in Gaza. This is extermination campaign. It doesn't spare anybody. But you are right also that it starts with journalists and doctors and university officials. Why? Because these people are the backbone of a civil society that can function and can also, of course, treat the injured and so forth. And so an extermination campaign requires removing witnesses, that's journalists, and it requires removing aid workers who help pull people from under the rubble or who help treat the injured so that it maximizes the number of people murdered in this extermination campaign.
Now more death and destruction in Lebanon as Israeli air and artillery strikes hit residential areas across the Arab country. The Lebanese Health Ministry says the regime's aggression against the Baalbek-Hermel region left at least 52 people dead on Friday. Another 72 people were also wounded in strikes on the eastern area. Attacks also hit the southern city of Tar, killing several people. More than a year into Israel's aggression against Lebanon, we've seen at least 2,900 people killed and over 13,200 injured. Meanwhile, Hezbollah has carried out fresh reprisal attacks against Israeli targets. Hezbollah says its rockets were fired toward an Israeli intelligence base near Tel Aviv. Rocket attacks set off sirens in the suburbs of Tel Aviv. Retaliatory attacks also caused damage to a building in the town of Tira and injured a number of people there. Earlier, the Lebanese resistance movement targeted a gathering of Israeli troops in southern Lebanon, the town of Khiyam. Hezbollah says attacks are in response to Israel's aggression against Lebanon, as well as in support of Palestinians in Gaza and their resistance. Earlier, our correspondent in Beirut, Mariam Saleh, updated us on latest Israeli attacks against Lebanon.
All attempts for a ceasefire on the diplomatic front have seemed to fail. Of course, the number of martyrs is mostly fixed in the last 24 hours and the last 48 hours, actually, in the eastern parts of the country, specifically in the Baalbek and the Bekaa region, Baalbek and Hermel specifically. We also have various attacks in areas which were not given prior warning, like Bidnaya, like Suhmur and Yuhmur, as well as areas like Al-Karak and various towns in all around the Bekaa, which were not given prior warning. There were, of course, a big number of families that were killed as a result of these attacks. The Lebanese High Commission of the Emergency also stated that there were at least 120 Israeli strikes all across the country. This is in addition to the Bekaa, the southern suburbs of Beirut, as well as South Lebanon, is at some 30 martyrs. Of course, the number has increased definitely and drastically. We're talking about more than 40 martyrs in the Bekaa area alone. That definitely raises the number of martyrs in general, in addition to the number of the injured, more than 183 injured also in the last 24 hours. And they also are saying that there is an average of one child that is killed on a daily basis.
And now back to one of our top stories with respect to the latest atrocities committed by the Israeli regime in the besieged Gaza Strip. We have our standby now. We check in with our Gaza correspondent, Muti Abu Musab, joining us in the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah. Hope you're safe. Tell us what you can, please.
Yes, actually, the obnoxious Israeli occupation forces continue to attack and decimate various parts of Gaza Strip. Here in the middle area of Gaza Strip, at least five Palestinian civilians were murdered after the Israeli occupation forces targeted a residential building in Al-Nusarat refugee camp. In addition to that, the Israeli occupation forces continue to attack the residential areas in the northern part of Al-Nusarat refugee camp, as they are still working on expanding the south side of Nisraim corridor. This is why they are still, as you know, detonating and blasting more residential buildings and squares in that area. Those explosions are still loud enough to be heard from different parts of the middle area of Gaza Strip. And even the eastern parts of Deir al-Balah city witnessed more, as you know, brutal attacks over the last night, particularly when it comes to the airstrikes that hit different parts of the eastern side of Deir al-Balah city. Moving to Gaza City, at least three Palestinian civilians were reportedly killed after the Israeli fighter drones attacked a gathering of the Palestinian people in As-Saftawi area. Those people, as you know, were gathering in order to obtain something to eat or to feed their children. However, the Israeli occupation forces leave no stone without unturned without attacking those Palestinian families and people. The As-Saftawi area is still witnessing more attacks against residential buildings, whereas the Israeli occupation forces detonated and blew up more residential buildings there. In addition to that, the southern part of Gaza Strip actually witnessed more cruel attacks by the Israeli occupation forces, particularly when it comes to the artillery shelling, which was maintained heavily over the last night. And even when it comes to the northern part of Gaza Strip, it is still, as you know, subjected to more cruel and brutal attacks amid the ongoing genocidal campaign targeting the northern part of Gaza Strip. We are talking about more than 28 consecutive days, and the Israeli occupation forces are still targeting every corner of the northern part of Gaza Strip. Beit Lahia city was subjected to more brutal and constant airstrikes over the last night, and even when it comes to Jabalia refugee camp, it was also subjected to more airstrikes and attacks. The Israeli occupation forces are still attacking the gatherings of the Palestinian people there. So we can see clearly that the Israeli occupation forces are still escalating their crimes and atrocities against the Palestinian people, who are still, as you know, suffering from the unbearable humanitarian conditions due to the ongoing suffocating siege imposed on the northern part of Gaza Strip specifically and the general areas of Gaza Strip.
Thank you, Moti. Stay safe. Moti Abu Musab updating us from Gaza. Meanwhile, the Islamic Resistance in Iraq says it's carried out new operations striking a number of Israeli targets deep inside occupied territories. The umbrella group of Iraqi resistance factions said it attacked a vital target in north occupied lands with drones. Group had also carried out six operations on Friday on targets in north, center, and south of occupied territories. Second target was located in the Jordan Valley and the third in occupied Golan Heights. Islamic Resistance says its operations are in support of Palestinian and Lebanese people and stress strikes are also in response to massacres carried out by the Israeli regime against civilians, including women, children, and the elderly across occupied territories. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis staged a rally in the capital Sana'a on Friday in support of latest military achievements by resistance in Lebanon and Gaza, as Yusuf Mowry reports.
Pro-Palestine and pro-Lebanon protests swept across Yemen after Friday prayers, with demonstrators reigniting support for the armed resistance against the Israeli regime in Gaza and Lebanon. The protesters celebrated the appointment of Sayyid Naeem Qassem as Hezbollah's new Secretary General, expressing hope that he will lead the Islamic Resistance Group in Lebanon towards its goal.
We came out today across the country in solidarity with the Axis of Resistance and the appointment of Hezbollah's Deputy Secretary General, Said Naim Qassem. We say to him, carry forward the banner of Said Hassan Nasrallah. We will support you, and you can always count on us.
We congratulate Hezbollah on the appointment of Said Naim Qassem as the new leader. We are confident he will carry forward the same message and the same method as Said Hassan Nasrallah.
Protesters also expressed a willingness to cross borders and engage in direct combat with Israeli forces. For now, however, Yemen's drones and missiles, including hypersonic missiles, are capable of reaching Tel Aviv in less than 12 minutes.
By Allah, we are very eager to meet the Zionists directly on the battlefield. We are also eager to escalate our military operations against them. Their attacks only make us stronger and more determined.
The Yemeni attacks are calculated to denigrate Israel's economic stability and diminish its regional influence. As the conflict escalates, Yemen's forces continue to employ advanced military capabilities, challenging Israel and the West. Another Friday of pro-Palestinian protests took place across the country after a series of military operations by Yemen's armed forces against Israeli interests across the region. The leader of Ansarullah says if the U.S. is unable to stop Yemen's military operations in the Red Sea, no one can. Yusuf Mawri, Sana'a.
Now, with just days to go before Americans vote in a U.S. presidential election, voters remain divided over some key issues, including laws regulating abortion rights that looms large over the race between Kamala Harris and Donald Trump. Our correspondent, Rachel Hamdoun in New York, has provided further details regarding this issue in the upcoming presidential vote.
The topic of abortion is a significant factor in the voting process for this presidential election, as it highlights the divide between the conservative population, which predominantly supports Republicans, and the liberal community, which largely aligns with Democrats. Now, tensions have been escalating, particularly following the 2022 revocation of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision that had been in place since 1973, establishing the right to abortion. This reversal has raised significant questions about the legality of the matter and sparked a debate over whether it should be considered a constitutional right. Now, the Democrats, alongside presidential candidate Kamala Harris, are working to restore Roe v. Wade and reestablish the legality of abortion. Harris is prioritizing this issue within the framework of women's and reproductive rights, as she leverages her identity as a woman of color to connect with and gain support from women and minority communities. Meanwhile, Trump has expressed mixed views on the matter as he has backed the 2022 decision to revoke the abortion law in alignment with his pro-life stance. But at the same time, he's maintained that he does not support a national ban on abortion and instead is advocating for states to make their own decisions on each case. Trump believes that abortion should only be permitted in specific circumstances, such as if the mother's life is at risk or in danger, and cases of rape. Rachel Hamdoun, New York.
Tehran has denounced Berlin for closing Iranian consulates in Germany, calling the move a sanction against Iranians residing in the European country. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, in a post on X, said Berlin is punishing tens of thousands of Iranians who are German citizens as well in support of a terrorist and under the guise of protecting German nationals. Germany ordered closure of Iranian consulates after Iran's execution of an Iranian-German national who had been convicted of involvement in terrorist attacks. Iran's foreign minister said Germany is trying to protect a terrorist who killed 14 innocent people and injured at least 200 others. Araghchi assured Iranians Tehran will do its best to compensate for this inconvenience caused by Germany's unjustified move. The head of Iran's Strategic Council on Foreign Relations has warned that the country could change its entire military doctrine if it faces an existential threat. Kamal Kharazi made the comments in an interview with Lebanon's Al-Mayadeen television channel amid tensions with Israel. He said Iran is capable of producing nuclear weapons, but a decree by leader of the Islamic Revolution banned such weapons as so far as prevented Tehran from taking any such step. Kharazi added that Iran may also increase its range of missiles. A former foreign minister said Iran has so far limited the range of its weapons due to sensitivity of the matter in Europe. But then he said there is no longer a reason to continue the policy, seeing that the Europeans have been ignoring Iran's sensitivities, including on its territorial integrity. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. An Oxfam research has found that 50 of the world's richest billionaires produce on average more carbon emissions in under 3 hours than the average British person does in their entire lifetime. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. A report has found that high carbon emissions of the world's richest 1% are worsening hunger, poverty and excess death. Owning to luxury yachts, private jets and investments in polluting industries, the consumption of the world's wealthiest people is also making it increasingly difficult to limit global heating to 1.5 degrees Celsius. The Oxfam analysis said if everyone on Earth emitted planet-warming gases at the same rate as the average billionaire, the remaining carbon budget to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius would be gone in less than 2 days, rather than current estimates of 4 years, if carbon emissions remain as they are today. Preceding a budget in the United Kingdom, a presidential election in the United States and the COP29 climate summit in Baku, Republic of Azerbaijan, the anti-poverty group's examination of carbon inequality calls on governments to tax the super-rich in order to curtail excessive consumption and generate revenue for the transition to clean energy and to compensate those worst affected by global warming. Oxfam's research found that 50 of the world's richest billionaires produce on average more carbon emissions in under 3 hours than the average British person does in their entire lifetime. On average, they take 184 private jet flights in a single year, spending 425 hours in air. This produces as much carbon as the average person in the world would in 300 years. Their luxury yachts emit as much carbon as the average person would in 860 years. The Amazon founder, Jeff Bezos's two private jets, spent nearly 25 days in the air over a 12-month period and released as much carbon as a U.S. Amazon employee would emit in 207 years. Two jets belonging to billionaire Elon Musk, the second richest person in the world, and Tesla chief, jointly discharged as much carbon dioxide in the same period as 834 years' worth of emissions generated by an average person. Meanwhile, the three yachts of the Walton family, heirs of the Walmart retail chain, had a combined carbon footprint in 1 year of 18,000 tons, an amount similar to that of 1,714 Walmart shop workers. Ahead of the Labour government's first budget statement in the coming days, Oxfam is calling on Britain's Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, to increase taxes on climate-polluting extreme wealth, starting with private jets and superyachts, to raise funds which could be used to tackle the climate crisis. In response, a UK Treasury spokesperson said, "We do not comment on speculation around tax changes outside of fiscal events." The Oxfam researchers developed a methodology for calculating the carbon emissions from yachts that included data on the size of the vessel, engine specifications, fuel type, hours at sea, and even generators for hot tubs and air conditioning for helicopter hangars. Alex Maitland, one of the authors of the report, said, "One of the key findings for us is that superyachts are by far the most polluting toy that a billionaire can own, except perhaps for a rocket ship. Far more destructive still are the greenhouse gas emissions from the investments of the ultra-rich, which are 340 times higher than the carbon dioxide from their yachts and jets. On average, the portfolio of the 50 billionaires in the study were almost twice as polluting as an investment in the main US stock index. Almost 40% of their shareholdings were in emissions-intensive industries such as oil, mining, shipping, and cement. Many of these companies also hire lobbyists and marketing professionals to delay or disrupt action on the climate." Oxfam says investment is also the area that has the greatest potential for positive change because, unlike most poor and middle-income people, billionaires have a choice about how to use their money. If they were to switch their holdings into low-carbon intensity funds, their investment emissions would be 13 times lower. The report also projects the deadly consequences of carbon inequality. In the coming century, 1.5 million excess deaths will be caused by the consumption emissions of the richest 1% of the population, those with incomes of at least $140,000 between 2015 to 2019. It says the past three decades of consumption emissions of this wealthy group have caused global economic output to fall by $2.9 trillion and crop losses equivalent to the calorie needs of 14.5 million people a year. Chiara Liguori, Oxfam's senior climate justice policy advisor, said, "The evidence is clear. The extreme emissions of the richest, from their luxury lifestyles and even more from their polluting investments, are fueling inequality, hunger, and threatening lives." Chiara Liguori added, "It's not just unfair that their reckless pollution is fueling the very crisis threatening our collective future. It's lethal." The findings are the latest in a series of annual carbon inequality reports by Oxfam. As The Guardian reported last year, the wealthiest 1% of the population, who tend to live climate-insulated, air-conditioned lives, mostly in the global north, produce as much carbon pollution as the 5 billion people who make up the poorest and most vulnerable two-thirds of the human population, who predominantly live in poorer countries in the south. The American newspaper The Washington Post has also covered the same story. The World Meteorological Organization, WMO, has said the concentration of planet-heating pollutants clogging the atmosphere hit record levels in 2023. It found carbon dioxide is accumulating faster than at any time in human history, with concentrations having risen by more than 10% in just two decades. Celeste Solo, Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, said, "Another year, another record. This should set alarm bells ringing among decision makers." The World Meteorological Organization found the increase was driven by humanity's stubbornly high burning of fossil fuels and made worse by big wildfires and a possible drop in the ability of trees to absorb carbon. The scientists observed the concentration of carbon dioxide reach 420 parts per million in 2023. The level of pollution is 51% greater than before the Industrial Revolution, when people began to burn large amounts of coal, oil and fossil fuels. Concentrations of strong but short-lived pollutants also surged. It said methane concentrations hit 1,934 parts per billion, a rise of 165% from pre-industrial levels, and nitrous oxide hit 336.9 parts per billion, a rise of 25%. Celeste Saulo said, "We are clearly off track to meet the Paris Climate Accord goal of limiting global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius and aiming for just 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. These are more than just statistics. Every part per million and every fraction of a degree temperature increases has a real impact on our lives and on our planet. Burning fossil fuels such as petrol to power cars or coal to feed our power plants releases gases that trap sunlight and heat the planet." The World Meteorological Organization warned that this heating can lead to climate feedbacks that are critical concerns to society.
Out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Lebanon's Prime Minister Najib Mirati has criticized Israel's expansion of attacks on his country. He said Israel's repeated threats to the population to evacuate entire cities and villages and its renewed targeting of Beirut and its suburbs indicate the Israeli enemy's rejection of all efforts to secure a ceasefire. The resumption of Israeli attacks on Lebanon's capital happened as U.S. envoys were in Israel on Thursday for talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. The meeting reportedly ended without any breakthrough. Meanwhile, many analysts believe that the conditions that the Israeli regime has set for a ceasefire with Lebanon are not realistic. Israel is demanding the freedom to operate even after a ceasefire and the freedom to target what it sees as threats and violations by Hezbollah. According to Hezbollah, this condition amounts to a surrender, and it's something the resistance group will never accept. That and more will be discussed on Spotlight. Here are our guests. Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nim, joining us from Ramallah. And also we have activist and political analyst Batul Sobeti joining us from the British capital, London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Professor Nimr in Ramallah. Yesterday, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said negotiations have made progress toward a deal that would bring a ceasefire in Lebanon. Now, that comment is questionable in itself, as the meeting reportedly ended without any breakthrough. But then Israel follows that up with a massive and deadly aggression against Lebanon, bombing many areas in the capital, Beirut. These actions are nothing new from the warmongers in Tel Aviv to prevent truce agreements.
Good evening to you and to your guests from London and all your viewers. Well, I think, yes, Blinken was absolutely right. There was a progress, but this progress in the negotiation, it was between Israel and the United States. It had nothing to do with Lebanon or Hezbollah. Nobody consulted them. Nobody talked to them anyway. And it is Hochstein who came to Tel Aviv. He sat with Netanyahu, and they had the talks. And Netanyahu gave him his conditions to end the war. And he left immediately back to Washington. He didn't even go to Lebanon. He didn't discuss that with Lebanon. And so the negotiations was between Israel and America. And they agreed. They agreed that all these conditions that the Israelis are adding to the resolution 1701 is absolutely right. And they, you know, both of them agreed that it is a good progress, you know, which allowed Israel to continue their war against Lebanon, while Hezbollah should stop all kind of atrocities or all kind of attacks on Israel at the same time. And Israel have the right, even after the full ceasefire, to continue to go into the Lebanese air and also targeted whoever they wanted, and also to monitor the airport and to monitor also the land crossings or land borders with Syria. And these are very nice conditions, I think, by the Israelis and the Americans. And I believe that the Israeli now, they want to say that we are the winners. We are now won this war. And consequently, we put our own conditions. But in reality, they are, you know, having lots of troubles in Lebanon now. And let them continue. Let them continue to have all these rockets coming and all these drones, as well as they can't even go few meters into Lebanon on the borders between Lebanon and occupied Palestine.
Bassel Soubeiti, in London, the Lebanese Prime Minister Najib Mirati had expressed hope that an agreement would be signed within days. Following the recent deadly Israeli airstrikes, Mirati said the expansion of the attacks on Lebanon and most notably Beirut suburbs and the regime's repeated threats to the population to evacuate entire cities and villages indicates Israel's rejection of efforts to secure a ceasefire. Is that what the Israelis are doing again?
Right, absolutely. America, this talk about ceasefire is absolute nonsense. It's been repeated for a whole year. America doesn't intend for a ceasefire now. We're a few days away from the American election date. America is in the corner when it comes to this issue and has no time, so it's all just propaganda talks. So we know America's not serious. We know that it has given Israel a free hand to do what it wants. The aggression effectively into Lebanon has been greenlit by America. Until now, the official Lebanese position has been the implementation of the UN resolution 1701 that the resistance in Lebanon has also agreed to. And that stipulates that Israel should not transgress on Lebanese sovereignty, whether that's through air or through sea. We've seen Nabih Berri, who is negotiating on that basis of the removal of the Israeli occupation entity from Lebanese territory. But we see that America, as the guest alluded to, through its negotiator, Hochstein, are saying that they want additions to this resolution that effectively break it through breaking Lebanese sovereignty and granting Israel the upper hand and giving it extra powers, you know, pushing the resistance, for example, behind the Litani River, giving extra authority to UNIFIL and the occupation forces to search areas relating to weapons depots, etc. America right now, the way we're seeing it is America's dealing with the resistance as a dead corpse that they want to bury. And they want to inherit the forces on the ground as though the resistance is already defeated. But the reality is that still stands, and that is that Israel cannot gain a single village. Israel is unable to enter effectively on the ground and consolidate its control in the Lebanese villages. The reality is that over 200 rockets per day continue to go into the heart of the Israeli occupation entity. The reality is that this month has been the most costly for the Israeli occupation entity since last year, October. So there is no ground for such talks. It's laughable. The military, what the military can't do, the political front cannot do. They want the resistance to basically take through politics what it cannot achieve through force, and that's effectively not going to happen.
Professor Nim, many analysts believe that the conditions that Israel has set for a ceasefire with Lebanon are not realistic. Israel is demanding the freedom to operate even after a ceasefire, and the freedom to target what it sees as threats and violations by Hezbollah. As we mentioned in the intro, Hezbollah said that these conditions are basically a way of surrendering, and it's something that they would never accept. Unpack that for us. Most notably, the stance of the resistance that has shown it will not budge in the face of the Israeli demands.
Yeah, well, let me just refer to the last speech of Naim Qasem, the Secretary General of Hezbollah. And he said quite clear, we agreed to the 1701 and nothing else. And if there is a ceasefire, it will be according to our conditions, the resistant conditions, meaning Israel is, you know, adding all these kind of conditions. And usually in such cases, the winners who are usually the one, or the victorious, who are the one who could put their terms and conditions. And the question is, did Israel win this war so far? Are they really, you know, as Batul just said, are they entering Lebanon, you know, to make sure that they are, you know, saying that, okay, we'll pull out of Lebanon, but we need, you know, more conditions. You didn't achieve anything apart from the only thing that they can do usually, which is, you know, killing people by the air force. This is the only thing they have in their hands, the superiority of the air, and they go and bombarded here and there and killing people and civilians, and now they are out even of targets. They started, you know, targeting now in Lebanon, you know, the ambulances, hospitals, and also a bank, you know. This is really ridiculous. And the Israeli think that these are kind of, you know, victories. They are not, but they know it. They know it, that they are not victorious, but they want to show that they are victorious and put their terms. But in reality, Hezbollah is going to continue, and then the Israeli have to come to their terms and pull back from the south of Lebanon and stop the war, even according to the, finally, according to the resolution 1701. And they can't do much better than that.
Ms. Sawaiti, Israel is bombing hospitals, clinics, and residential areas in Lebanon, just like it did in Gaza. Many are seeing the aggression against the Lebanese as basically a continuation of the Gaza genocide. The world watched idly as Israel flattened and demolished Gaza and murdered over 43,000 Palestinians. The same is happening now in Lebanon. What has to happen for the collective international community to take action and stop these massacres? And also, in your opinion, where does this leave the credibility of international bodies such as the United Nations, who have failed Palestinians and are now failing the Lebanese people as well?
Right. On your first point, once the Israeli occupation entity is unable to actually hit the resistance infrastructure, they go for the civilians and they go for the people that support the resistance. But also, it is also true that they're seeking to cause sedition between the different sects and people in Lebanon. So, for example, we see that there's a big focus on, for example, the Shias or this kind of conspiracy. The aim over here is to make the cost of war too much for the civilians to bear, to turn them against the resistance, and also to turn different sects in Lebanon against others. The UN will not take any action unless the Israeli occupation entity is really harmed. That's when it invokes its resolutions. And whatever the UN does is ultimately based on America's approval. So Israel has to be hurt enough for the UN to move. Otherwise, if Israel is doing well on the ground, no one will bat an eyelid for the people of the region and their rights and their struggles. So it's actually, in reality, it is the steadfastness of the resistance that ends up imposing the conditions. The solution will never come from the UN. The solution will come due to the resistance inflicting much harm on the ground, such that the Israeli occupation entity is failing and unable to achieve its goals, that will force America, which is Israel's guarantor, to kind of end this war. We have to understand that Israel doesn't understand political talks and decisions. Nothing but force works on them. Nothing even moves the UN resolutions except the resistance, and we know that those resolutions are invoked by the West to save Israel at its time of weakness. We also know right now that it's the US that has given Israel the free hand to act as they please, you know, setting the stage for a quote-unquote new Middle East by the end of this year. We all saw that speech by Netanyahu last month in his drunken high. This idea that if Israel is successful, you know, it stands to gain significant rewards, potentially expanding to include all of Palestine, parts of Lebanon, and beyond. So that's exactly the make-or-break moment right now for the Israeli occupation entity as far as America's concerned. Please prove yourself. For a whole year in Gaza, you've not managed to achieve a single military strategic objective. Now we've given you the free hand to operate in Lebanon to see what you're capable of. If you fail to defeat the resistance in Lebanon, this could jeopardize the Israeli occupation entity's whole current trajectory. And so we see America on the one hand redefining the functional role of the Israeli occupation entity. The only thing that will curb any of this is the steadfastness of the resistance that inflicts enough harm on Israel that forces America to think in terms of strategic interests.
Professor Nim, according to data by the Committee to Protect Journalists, the Israeli war on Gaza has killed more journalists over the past year than any other conflict over the past 30 years. We are seeing the same trend in Lebanon as well. And it's not just journalists. Medical workers claim Israel is targeting them directly. UN peacekeepers said they were forced to withdraw from an observation post in southwest Lebanon after being fired on by Israeli forces. Why does Israel target journalists, medics, and even UN peacekeepers?
Well, it's quite clear that, you know, how the Israelis are really reacting. And it's about time for the whole world to understand that these guys in Israel, this fascist government and their army, which they claim it's the most ethical army in the world, to see how ethical are they, you know, in complying with the international law, and they don't care at all. We are talking about more than 180 journalists already being killed by the Israeli Air Force and Israeli troops, whether it's in Gaza, Strip, or in Lebanon as well. And they are continuing with that, targeting the journalists, and because they don't want the truth to be said. They know that the images which all the media give out, and as well as the social media, had harmed them a lot in around the world. And everyone now is seeing their crimes and their genocidal war against the people and against, you know, even the unarmed people, and especially the women and children. And the same they are doing with the medical teams. When they are attacking, you know, hospitals, even now they are moving all that also to Lebanon. So after they, no one protested in what happened in Gaza, they are now trying to do it in Lebanon now. In Gaza, they destroyed the hospitals. Just, you know, last week they arrested all the medical team in the hospital in the north of Gaza after they fire on it and destroy everything. They destroy even the ambulances, and they also targeting the all kind of aid workers. And we are talking about international organizations, and we are talking about people who are, by the international law, supposed to be protected. Yet the Israelis, they don't care. And this is a clear message to the international community that I'm defying everything, and I don't care. do whatever you want, you know, to the extent that they outlawed the United Nations UNRWA, which is serving more than 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank and in Gaza. Now they outlaw it, and this is, you know, a challenge not only to the United Nations, it's a challenge to the whole international community. And yet this international community is not doing yet anything really significant to stop Israel from committing all these atrocities.
Right. Ms. Sobeiti, the most perplexing and I think appalling part of the targeting of journalists, medics, UN peacekeepers at this point is that there's been absolutely no accountability for the Israeli crimes that are being committed. So talk to us about that, please. And if there is no accountability, then it's just going to keep happening again and again.
Right. Change will not happen except with the formation of a new world order. As long as the world is being run by America at its helm, we know that Israel is simply the American project for the region. It's not this separate foreign entity. Then in that case, nothing will change. We have to understand that this is a struggle, and the struggle will not end until the Israeli occupation entity ends. Israel is a planted entity. The whole area refuses it. You know, we've seen the Oslo Accords that they tried to pass 30 years ago that completely failed. Why? Because the people and the nations of the region, even those normalizing governments like Egypt and Jordan, completely reject the occupation entity. It's built on the blood of the ethnically cleansed Palestinian people. As long as you have oppressed people calling for their rights, the struggle won't end. And in fact, the struggle will be victorious for the oppressed, you know, because what happens if the oppressed decide to organize themselves and have arms, as we're seeing today? You know, if we compare the reality that's unfolding to 20 years ago, you know, you currently have 7 active fronts, you know, as Netanyahu and the Israeli administration puts it. They're even talking about this 8th front. You know, Israel is talking about the need to introduce a brigade to basically focus its efforts on Jordan, because Jordan is becoming a threat. Threatening front to them because, you know, authorities are finding weapon depots, for example. And there's this kind of extra bridge from Jordan, which is a big threat because it's connected to Syria and Iraq. And we know that the Jordanian population is quite active and is rejecting the genocide and the occupation entity. And even if you look in 2006, for example, you see that the resistance in Lebanon was alone when it fought the July War. You see in 2021 in the Al-Quds sword battle, you know, there wasn't this unity of the fronts that we're seeing today. You know, Israel dealt with each part of the resistance access fronts separately. So today we're in a different era, you can say. We're ultimately witnessing the era of liberation. And that is, as the war continues, the resistance axis is developing and becoming even stronger. And so the development of war is the development of the resistance, and the Israeli occupation entity is drowning more and more. So there will never be accountability from America, except for the failures of Israel to actually defeat the resistance axis. That is where America will hold Israel accountable. We won't see this during war, but we'll see this post-war. Post-war, America will reprimand Israel for being a failing entity and unable to carry out the functional role for which America is supporting and sustaining Israel, and that is to strike any part of the region that falls against the American trajectory. Israel has proven that ultimately it is a failing entity, and politics runs on power and ability, and the weak has no place in the world of politics.
Professor Nim, how do you view the U.S.'s duplicitous stance regarding the Gaza genocide and Israel's ongoing regional crimes? Washington claims it's pushing for a ceasefire. It claims it doesn't want a broader regional war, but at the same time, it provides Israel with all the tools, the arsenal, the equipment necessary. And of course, let's not forget the all-out political support and the billions of dollars of U.S. taxpayers' money to continue to kill innocent women and children. And it's not just in Gaza anymore.
Well, yes, we said that many times, that the Americans are really involved in this war and are partners to the Israelis in this war and genocidal war against the Palestinians in Gaza. They are the only country who can stop Israel from doing anything. And yet they fail to stop or to make them agree to a ceasefire. It was their, the American, you know, initiatives many times, and Israel agreed to it, and then they changed their mind. Because by the end of the day, this administration also is very weak, and Netanyahu noticed that, and he don't care about them, and he's waiting for the elections, which is the American elections, which is coming in a few days, and he hoped that his friend Trump will be the next president, who promised him that he will let him do whatever he wants without any kind of pressure by the Americans. But so far, this Biden's administration, they helped Israel in every sense, in all the time, not only money and weapon and artillery and everything, and then to add to it also diplomatically by, you know, blocking any kind of resolution in the United Nations in order to stop or cease fire. So I think that the Americans are totally involved in this war, and they do exactly what the Israeli wanted. No, not just that, but also they start to justify the Israeli conditions and justify the Israeli atrocities. And sometimes they say, this is a little bit too much about, you know, the civilians, but at the same time they don't do nothing, you know, to stop Israel from doing that. How many times the American told the Israeli, don't go to Rafah, don't go to Rafah, and they did, and they committed all the crimes there. And yet, so the Israeli, they don't care even about the Americans, and they do whatever they want, and they know that whatever happened, America won't stop helping them and supporting them, because deeply, in as a deep state in America and Israel, the relationship is a strategic one, and they are not going to stop, you know, helping the Israelis anyway, regardless of sometimes some problems between an administration and a government in Israel. But the relationship between the two countries is totally a strategic one.
And a final question for Ms. Sawaiti, very briefly, if you may, because we're short of time for tonight's show. Many people view the inaction of some Arab regimes in the face of the ongoing genocidal war on Gaza as a significant factor contributing to the continued massacre of the Palestinians and now the Lebanese as well. Do you see it in that light as well?
Yes, the Arabs are not just turning a blind eye. They are a part of the conspiracy against this free movement, against the resistance axis. You know, we're talking about these countries that are opening their borders to the Israeli occupation entity, that are intercepting the resistance missiles and drones. And likewise, when countries from the resistance axis are targeted, like the Islamic Republic of Iran, they completely open their borders and allow the occupation entity to strike. So they are effectively a part and parcel of Israel's plan. And so it's not just a case of them being silent. And we know that if the Arab regimes, if they actually played a big role, they would have been able to effect real change in terms of boycott and besiegement. But they are giving the Israeli occupation entity effectively what it wants.
All right. Thanks a lot to Professor of Political Science at Birzeit University, Saad Nimr, joining us from Ramallah. And thanks, Status and Political Analyst Batul Sawaiti, joining us from the British capital, London. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's edition of Spotlight. It's good night for now.
With you. How about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله
answering it down some questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan?
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. We're welcome to another episode on Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Ahmad Danish is a special guest speaker from the Islamic House of Qom to answer today's questions. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Wa alaikum assalam. Hope all of you are well.
All right, Sheikh Ahmad Danish, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the reality of the chastisements and the, we can say, rewards of the other world, whether they are physical or bodily or spiritual. We know that both sides, I mean, the punishments or chastisements and the rewards of the other world are pictured in the Holy Quran, some of them in a very vivid, clear picture, which talks about the physicality of the rewards and the punishments. Still, some believe that these are only a kind of explanation to these concepts, and the reality is something else. Can you talk a little bit about the reality of the punishment and the reward? What are they exactly?
Yes. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Again, regarding the punishment of hellfire and on the Day of Judgment and the rewards on the Day of Judgment and the life hereafter, we have various verses of the Holy Quran as well as the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimus salam, which tell us that not only will these rewards and punishments be material or maddi, but they will also be spiritual punishments and rewards. So we have punishments that will be inflicted on the body of the disbelievers,
right,
and those people who went astray, as well as we will have punishments that will have the spiritual aspect. That is, some of the punishments that have been told in the Holy Quran pertain to the food that these people will be given,
mm-hmm,
right? And zakum is one of the foods that has been mentioned. That is something that will inflict a lot of pain when these people have this this food,
right,
as well as the liquids that they will be given,
mm-hmm,
to quench their thirst. It's been written in the Holy Quran that it will be so hot that it will all
burn away their
bodies. And so when we get these sorts of verses of the Holy Quran, we realize that it will not only be spiritual and something that is going to inflict pain on their souls, but it will also inflict pain on their bodies.
And so these pictures were given directly by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to Prophet Muhammad, or no, these are the wordings of Prophet Muhammad himself?
These are the wordings of the verses of the Holy Quran,
uh-huh,
right? So some of the verses that we have in the Holy Quran speak about these different kinds of foods that they will be given,
mm-hmm,
right? For example, we have zakum. We have zari,
yes.
Then we have hamim for the things that they will be given to drink. And so all of these are things that a human craves for, right?
Yes.
So one of the things that a human craves for is things to eat and to drink.
Mm-hmm.
But those things will be converted into punishment for them.
All right.
And again, when it speaks about the clothing that they will be given,
all right,
right, the clothing is a clothing of fire,
mm-hmm,
right? Fire will engulf them with their clothing. So all of these is suggesting that they will be given punishment not only through their food, but also through their clothing, as well as they will be captured by the angels with their hands tied in hell,
mm-hmm,
and the angels will be hitting on their heads.
All right,
right, and some of the people of hellfire will be raised blind.
Mm-hmm.
So all of this is suggesting that there will be material punishments for them.
Are there kind of threat or warning to the evildoers in order to stop them from committing sins? I mean, for example, since Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves his creatures and wants them to get into the perfect way, so he threatens them and warns them with such punishments, or no, they're really going to happen. Since Allah is Rahman and Rahim, these are not compatible with the Rahmaniyah and Rahimiyah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right. Is it so?
We know that the Holy Quran says that Wasi'at Rahmatuhu Kulla Shay, right? Yes. And his mercy has engulfed everything. Mm-hmm. So his mercy has even engulfed his ghadab. But at the same time, we know that when the Holy Quran speaks about a certain topic and it gives specific details about the punishment of the people of hellfire, we mean serious business here. We cannot say that these are just for threatening the people of hellfire. But the language of the Holy Quran is such that these people will taste this punishment.